My parents are immigrants. My dad's a Palestinian refugee. He told me all the time, it doesn't matter what your name is, you can make it in this country. And he always told us success is not about being really rich. It's about being able to make decisions for your own life and provide for your family.
Since arriving in Washington in 2011, 37-year-old Republican Justin Amash of Michigan has cast more consistently libertarian votes than any other member of Congress. He's also known for explaining each of his votes on Facebook and maintaining a lively Twitter feed where he excoriates Democrats and Republicans alike whenever they seek to expand the size, scope, and spending of the federal government. The omnibus is one of the worst and most costly pieces of legislation ever to become law, period. That's why I voted no, Amash tweeted after his congressional colleagues passed a 2,300-page bill they clearly had not read. A lawyer by training, he's an outspoken defender of due process, civil liberties, and defendants' rights. He is also resolutely non-interventionist and friendly towards immigrants. We caught up recently with Congressman Amash at Reason Weekend, our annual donors retreat, held this year in West Palm Beach, Florida.
Over the past couple of months, Congress has passed a budget deal that increases spending by about $300 billion. It lifted the last of the budget caps from 2011, reauthorized domestic surveillance. The House overwhelmingly passed a sex trafficking bill that goes directly, it'll do less about sex trafficking, but it will open up a lot of online speech to government regulation, which it had protected. And my first question then to you is, why? Remind us why anyone should vote Republican?
Well, first, the Two Parties Must Die is going to be the name of our album as the boy band.
Yeah.
So,
yes. Amash and Gillespie. So, it'll be like bookend.
Two Parties Must Die. Yeah. So why should I vote Republican? Well, because I'm a Republican. So people in my district should vote Republican. But the Republican Party hasn't given people very many reasons to vote Republican. And the Democratic Party hasn't given people reasons to vote for Democrats. So, you know, I think the main reason that people might vote Republican right now is because it's a two-party system, really. And I think you have efforts by the Libertarian Party and some other parties. It hasn't really reached beyond, say, 5%, 10% in most areas.
Yeah.
So, part of that is because the system is in many respects rigged to prevent a third party from rising up. And we have a system that's designed to benefit these parties. The rules are designed to benefit the parties. In the state of Michigan, we have the straight ticket voting where people basically are incentivized to vote Republican or Democrat at the top of the ticket and just walk out of the polling booth. So you'd have to change some of the rules. And I think that you have to present alternatives that are broadly appealing. I do think there is a libertarian alternative that is broadly appealing and can be presented.
You know, one of the reasons I think there's a sociological reason why the libertarian movement, small L, and Republicans kind of come together because the Republican rhetoric, you know, at least from Barry Goldwater on through Reagan and to the present day is often very libertarian. It's about limiting government. It's about maximizing individual liberty. It's about cutting spending and being fiscally responsible. What can be done to pull the Republican Party to, you know, at least live up to some of its rhetoric?
You have to elect the right people. So I think people at home keep falling for the same garbage. Now, there's some movement within the Republican Party toward nationalism and protectionism. If that's what the party becomes about, then that's a very different sort of Republican Party. And I'm not sure that coalition can hold together.
But what's interesting about that is you're from Michigan. You represent Grand Rapids, among other parts of Michigan. You know, this is an industrial part of the country that went, you know, for Trump. I mean, they helped go to, you know, make Trump president, partly based on that populist, nationalist, restrictionist, protectionist appeal. Are you crazy? I mean, like, are you facing a backlash among your constituents for saying, no, you know, free trade is still a good thing?
No, not in my area. Now, in other parts of Michigan, that's true. I mean, we can get into Michigan politics and see how the state breaks down.
Yes.
Go blue. In my part of Michigan, in the western part of Michigan, actually, both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were less popular than their counterparts in the previous election. So Donald Trump did worse than Mitt Romney. Hillary Clinton did worse than Barack Obama, which actually shows that there is a desire for something else. I did much better than Donald Trump did in my district. And he got clobbered in the city of Grand Rapids, 63-30. So I think there is a desire for something else. I think the vast majority of Americans are for that something else. And what you have right now are two parties that are relatively small and weak. And actually, the reason they are so partisan right now is because they are small and weak. When you get parties that are that small, that weak, you start to have the fringier elements of each party rise up and make the noise. And libertarian views are actually the mainstream views. If you go around my district and talk to people, most people have generally libertarian views. Now, would they call themselves libertarians? Would they say, hey, I'm a libertarian? Not necessarily, but they have a set of principles that are American principles embedded in this culture, in this society, and they are fairly libertarian principles. And I think we need to be able to present that to them and find some way to present an alternative going forward. I think as these parties get smaller and smaller, there will be more independents. And maybe a third party has a chance. But I think the future I see is one where there are no strong parties and more independent candidates. We don't really need the parties anymore.
Talk about that. Is that because of technology? Is it because you can? I mean, one of the things that I suspect many people here are aware of, Representative Amash explains his votes on Facebook. And I know I've done this, and I think a lot of journalists do. Like, when you don't really understand what the hell Congress is voting on, you can go to his page because he lays out, regardless of his decision, he lays out what's going on. But is it because of technological change? Because we also hear, you know, money is more important in politics than ever, and you are only going to get money through personal fortunes or party operations.
I think the ability to spread information is more important than the money and more important than the parties. You could not have had candidates like me 20 or 30 years ago before the rise of the internet. It would not have happened. The party would have crushed you before you got out of the gate. It used to be the case that with so little information going around, you had to depend on the parties to tell you what a member of Congress was about. You wouldn't even hear about what was going on in Washington. You just know that Republicans did this, Democrats did that. And you generally knew, well, my guy's a Republican, so he went along with the Republicans, and the Democrats had their thing going. You'd hear very little about the individual things that are going on in Congress. Now you can find out what a member of Congress had for lunch, because we're tweeting it out, we're putting it on Facebook. You know a lot more, and therefore the power of the parties is waning. I don't think that's why they're getting smaller and weaker, and I don't think they're as necessary. Americans, I think, need to wake up to that fact a little more and say, we don't need these parties to be the dominant thing. I tell young people all the time, you don't have to be a Republican or a Democrat. You can be whatever you want to be. Just go and fight for your beliefs and be as independent as you can. Just do your thing.
Let's talk about fiscal responsibility, which used to be a byword of Republican politics. What specifically worries you about the possible return of trillion-dollar deficits, annual deficits? Why is that a bad thing?
Well, it's bad for the next generation. I mean, you have these debts that are going to get out of the debt's going to get out of control. These deficits are going to be in the near future. There'll be $2 trillion annual deficits. I mean, we're going to have a $1 trillion annual deficit coming up. It won't be long before we have $2 trillion annual deficits. And there's only so long this can work out. I mean, it can't work out indefinitely. It can work out in the near term because the United States remains the dominant economy of the world. We remain the wealthiest country of the world. So there are those advantages we have, but those advantages aren't permanent. They're not automatic. They're not guaranteed to us. It depends on how we run our system. And if this debt gets out of control, the next generation is going to have a problem with it. We are basically spending money that they would like to use for things. We are spending money that is borrowed from people who will have to pay it back in the future. And
it really kind of sucks to be them.
And it does. And it's my children who are going to suffer, and my grandchildren. And you also have there are other issues. Interest rates can go way up if you have a massive debt. There are other issues.
You know, you touched on the idea that the United States, since the end of World War II, has been able to take for granted that we are the superpower in the world, or we're one of two and then one of one. That's changing now, and it seems as if America, in a weird way, Trump promised to make America great again, which implies that we're not as great as we used to be, and we're not going to be as great just because power and knowledge and economic growth is spreading out around the world. Things are decentralized more. Talk about that in the context of national defense, because this is also something Republicans, one of the reasons they were willing to cut a deal to break budget caps was so that they could fund more military stuff. You're very much of a principled, certainly not an isolationist, but you speak on behalf of non-interventionism or non-stupid wars. Mm-hmm. Is the Republican Party or the Republican leadership going to catch up to the idea that we don't have to be everywhere all the time in the world for it to get on with its business?
No, this leadership's not going to figure that out. After this election, maybe people will start to wake up a little more. But there's such a level of stupidity right now in the way we spend money. I mean, it's not just that we're spending a lot; it's stupid. For example, if you take national defense, I think most people in this room, if you read the Constitution, I think most people everywhere agree. Defense is a top priority for the sure. federal government. That's kind of why we have a federal government, right? It's so that the states could team up and provide for some kind of national defense. If you look at the enumerated powers, a lot of it's about defense. That doesn't mean we need to keep increasing the defense budget to astronomical levels. Right now, we're spending as much as the next, I think, 8 countries combined. It doesn't take much more spending to be spending as much as the next 20 countries combined, because the countries get the spending gets smaller and smaller. So how much is too much? And most of those countries, by the way, are allies. These are not enemies. Like if you look at the top 10 spending countries, maybe two of them would have hostile or semi-hostile relationships right. with us. So most of them are allies. And I think it's absurd to have the Department of Defense telling us we don't need to spend money on X item. And then Congress saying, we're going to spend money on that thing. Even the Department of Defense says we don't need it. And what happens in these districts, the defense contractors, they put facilities in 60, 70, 80 districts. And they build part of a machine here, part here, part here. And then they go to every member of Congress who has those facilities. And they say, well, you don't want these jobs to be lost in your district, do you? It's a jobs program. We have to keep these jobs going. And that's why the spending keeps going up. You have special interests coming in and asking for more. It's not because the military is asking for it, the armed forces are asking for it. It's because of the spending. And then it's because of the defense contractor spending. And then we have these wars, of course, that we're fighting, like in Afghanistan, where we spend more per year in Afghanistan. And my friend Thomas Massey pulled these numbers up for me. More per year than the entire defense budget of Germany or the entire defense budget of the United Kingdom. And we spend that just in Afghanistan. So that's crazy.
Defense or national security is not just about the Department of Defense or the Pentagon. It's also about things like the surveillance state. The most recent shakeup, could you quickly give a sense of, are you happy with the idea of somebody like Mike Pompeo, who had been a congressman, was at the CIA, is now at Secretary of State? He's a big surveillance guy, a big hawk. Gina Haspel is now the CIA chief. And Assuming McMaster is fully bounced, you get somebody like John Bolton. Is your side winning when this happens?
No. So I know Mike because I served with him. Mike's a nice guy. We had a good relationship. I don't agree with him at all on surveillance issues. The others, I don't know. But it's certainly not the type of thing I think President Trump was talking about on the campaign trail. I don't think he imagined sort of neocon, hawkish foreign policy establishment coming in. But if that's what he's going for, it's going to be very different from what he was telling people on the campaign trail. And that would be a real shame. I don't think when people elected Donald Trump, they wanted us to go back to George W. Bush. You know, which is better. We can debate that. But I don't think that's what people are asking for. They're not asking for a George W. Bush type of foreign policy. They're not asking for, I think, a Donald Trump type of foreign policy either. I think both are maybe extremes in different ways. So I think we can do a lot better. We should put in some non-interventionist types in the State Department, and we should put in non-interventionist types in his cabinet and advisors. People who will give him realistic perspectives on the world so that we can make sound decisions that protect our country and don't get us entangled in all sorts of wars and other activities that we don't need to be involved in.
You had mentioned trade as a place that it the country seems to be going backwards. Your friend Thomas Massey, when Trump pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, he was kind of in favor of that on the grounds of national sovereignty. You guys, the two of you, are pretty much plainly the most libertarian members of Congress, of the House of Representatives. Why is he wrong in that? What does it say about the libertarian contingent that you guys were split on pulling out of a trade deal?
Well, I couldn't tell you that he's wrong because we didn't get through TPP. I didn't spend time reading it because I thought it wasn't going to come up. I'll tell you where we agreed, though. We believe that Congress should have authority over trade, not the president. It's primarily a congressional function. Now, we understand why you'd have one person or a small group of people negotiating deals, but Congress ultimately must make the decision on trade, and we shouldn't delegate that authority. We had this legislation called TPA, which was prior to TPP, so we never got to vote on TPP. But TPA was voted on, and I voted no on TPA.
And that was trade promotion.
That was trade promotion authority. Yeah. And the reason I voted no on that is because they said they wanted to delegate through this bill, delegate authority to the president to negotiate these deals, and then we just get one up or down vote at the end. And I think that's a mistake. I think that you have to maintain congressional authority over these things, which means as negotiations are going on, Congress should have some input to say to the administration, yes, you may continue or no, you may not, because you have these trade deals going on for sometimes 7 years in the negotiations. And if you just give Congress an up or down vote at the very end, what ends up happening is there is so much political pressure on the members of Congress to support the deal no matter what it is, because they're told, well, you really don't want to. They get all the businesses coming into their from their districts, coming into their offices. Oh, you really don't want to sabotage this trade deal. We were negotiating it for 7 years. You want us to start over on this thing? So you really have to have checks along the way. And they didn't have that. I think Congress has done a bad job. We recently had a bill to give the president authority to lower tariffs on people. I think I was the only member of Congress to vote no. And the reason I voted no was because we are, again, delegating our authority to the president. And we shouldn't do that.
You're wearing a lumberjack shirt. He's becoming a lumber sexual. Look it up. Google it. You're strong, you're brawny, you're like selling paper towels up here. How do you get Congress? This has been a theme over recent weekend. How do you get Congress to actually do its job and say, we're not delegating everything anymore? I mean, it's like Congress has been outsourcing its job to the president in the last three, and arguably the last 40-something presidents haven't been that good. What can be done?
So I go back to people at home can vote new people in. But at the end of the day, the Speaker of the House has a lot of authority. I think you need the right Speaker of the House in there. We don't have that right now. We didn't have it with the previous Speaker either. We're certainly not going to have it with Nancy Pelosi.
And you don't want to bring Dennis Hastert back.
We don't want to bring
Hastert
back.
Yeah.
So there are no speakers on the horizon, whether it's the current speaker or Nancy Pelosi, who are going to fix this problem. The speaker has to protect the institution, and the Speaker of the House is not doing that. The Speaker of the House is in the business of protecting members of Congress right now, protecting them from themselves. So he and previous speakers go out of their way to prevent us from voting on things. They don't want us to go on the record. If there's a war, they want that war to be fought without members of Congress having any input, because then afterwards you can decide whether you supported it or opposed it. You can decide after the fact. Did it go well? Okay, I was for it. Did it go poorly? Oh, I was against that the whole time. That's what they want in everything, whether it's trade, whether it's wars. They don't want members of Congress to do their jobs. They're not protecting, the speaker has not been protecting the institution. So you need a speaker in there who is an institutionalist, who cares about the institution first, who is not a partisan. Let the House work its will. Let legislation come to the floor. Let Republicans and Democrats and others offer their amendments. And let's have votes on all sorts of things. Substantive things, not just post offices like they do now. Substantive things.
Do a lot of post offices get voted down, by the way? They never get voted down.
Yeah, not one is ever lost.
So it's a very safe vote.
Maybe if I put my post office bill on the floor, they might get voted down. But no other post offices lose. So let's have substantive votes. And if a bill or an amendment fails, so be it. This is what drives me crazy. They don't want to have any failures. They want everything to be rigged. They want to know in advance this is going to fail or this is going to pass. And if it's going to fail, they don't put it on the floor. But actually, we should have a process where things can fail, where the American people can see this vote was put up, it didn't pass. And we move on to something else. We try something else. At the end of the day, if you let the House work its will, libertarians aren't going to be happy with a whole lot of things. There'll be a lot of things we're upset about. Republicans aren't going to be happy about everything. Democrats aren't going to be happy about everything. But we create a market. We create a mechanism for people to make corrections. So people at home can see what happened and make adjustments, saying, I don't like this guy. I don't like the way he's voting. I'm going to vote for someone else. And it allows someone like me who has libertarian ideas to bring those to the floor and present them and have a debate. Because right now, we very rarely get to debate our ideas. I want to be able to go to the floor every day to debate libertarian ideas and present them and have the American people judge whether people made the right vote or the wrong vote on my amendment or my bill.
You've been talking a lot about libertarianism, and one of the themes of this past couple of days at Reason Weekend have been how do we reach new people? How do we convert people? How do we engage people? Where did your libertarian ideas come from? And are you winning? I mean, obviously the past two Republican speakers of the House kind of hate your guts. You're not winning any friends or influencing people there. But what is, where did your ideas come from? And then how do you sell them within Congress and within your district?
Well, I think I was born libertarian.
It's kind of like fetal alcohol syndrome.
I don't know what
epigenetics. But
I had a very, I was very much against arbitrary authority from childhood. Back then, for example, I remember our PE teacher. He gave some, I don't know what they call them, timeouts or detentions or something to some students for playing basketball in the gym during recess, and I got upset about it. This was like in seventh grade. And I said to him, well, why'd you get these kids in trouble? Why are these kids in trouble? We always get to play basketball in the gym during recess. That's just how it is. And he said, well, this afternoon, there's like going to be some presentation happening in the gym and we're setting some stuff up, so they're not supposed to be in there. And I said, well, did you provide notice? Did you?
I'm seeing the coach's point.
Was there Was there notice to these kids? I mean, this seems really arbitrary to just, they're in trouble for something they weren't even notified of. So I was like fighting for the rule of law at that point. And I got into all sorts of trouble because of that stuff with teachers and, and others. But I think it was really ingrained in me at a young age. I've talked about this elsewhere, but my parents are immigrants. My dad's a Palestinian refugee. And I think that a lot of his experience rubbed off on me, that he came from a place where he had no rights. He came here as a refugee. He told me all the time how wonderful it was to be in this country, how blessed we were to have been born in this country, that we have an opportunity here. And it doesn't matter how poor you are. He came here extremely poor, like with absolutely nothing. And it doesn't matter how poor you are or what your last name is, you know, Amash, like that doesn't fit in West Michigan. Maybe Amashstra or Vander Amash or something. But it doesn't matter what your name is, you can make it in this country. And he always told us when we were kids, success is not about being really rich. It's about being able to make decisions for your own life and provide for your family. And that's what he wanted us to be able to do. And he worked very hard to do that. And I think that really made a huge impression on me as a kid. And it's why I was against arbitrary authority. It's why I believed so much in this country. I believe in liberty and the rule of law and our Constitution. It's because of a lot of that, I think.
Does that, does that kind of rhetoric, I mean, the rhetoric, I'm sure, is accepted by your colleagues, but, you know, the meat of those arguments, are they like, yeah, that's all beautiful. Now let's, here's a trade restriction. Here's a war. Here's stupid spending. What are the ways to get past people paying lip service to these great ideals?
I think two of the problems I run into with my colleagues, one is that a lot of them don't read the legislation or know much about it. So they don't really know what it is when it comes to the floor. But the other thing is, a lot of them know that I'm right. They're not like, we'll go to the floor and I'll say, hey, this is a bad bill because of X, Y, or Z, and we'll talk about it. And let's say you're absolutely right. And then they'll vote the wrong way. And it's because they're afraid the bill title says something about protecting children or, it has something to do with a current event. And they're worried about being on the wrong side of public opinion on it. And I think that affects a lot of the voting. So there'll be people who absolutely know they're doing the wrong thing and they'll still vote that way because they're worried about public opinion. And Massey always says, tries to convince people by saying, it's a freebie now. We've had so many bad votes now that you might as well just take this one too. The point is, I think that you should do the right thing and then go home and explain it to people. And I actually, I believe in the American people. I believe in my constituents.
You left out apple pie and children.
Yeah.
I think that's
one of the things that maybe distinguishes my approach from my colleagues, is that I have a deep belief in my constituents. Like, I really believe in them to do the right thing. I really do. I think my colleagues are much more cynical about how the public operates. I think that if you go and you put yourself before them, as I do at town halls and other things, and you explain yourself, people will connect with you. They'll appreciate what you're doing. They may find that they agree with you on so many things that they didn't think they agreed with you on. They'll find that you share the same principles that they share. So you just have to put yourself out there and be open, and you'll find that people are much more accepting of what you do and even supportive of what you do than if you don't do those things. If you hide, if you try to go with the pack on everything, I think you never get to experience that like I do. And that's why I have like a deep faith in the people back home.
Part of that is your willingness and ability to communicate directly with them, whether it's in town halls, Representative Amash, in a couple of seasons where Congress people were, vacationing in France rather than going home to their districts, because they were going to get eggs and cabbage thrown at them. You weathered that pretty well. You talked directly to them, via the internet. With this sex trafficking bill, SESTA, is the name of it. Part of what it does is it attacks the doctrine that a publisher of a website is not necessarily liable for things that people put on a bulletin board or on a job listing or at the comments at a political website like Reason. This was a very important early decision as the World Wide Web was becoming powerful, that there was immunity so that you could have more discussions online. How worried are you about something like SESTA shutting down free speech? And what are the other threats to free speech that you see, that we really need to be taking seriously?
Well, I think it's the first step. I don't think it itself mm-hmm. is going to shut down free speech, but it starts the movement in that direction, and that makes me nervous. One other thing about that bill, is an ex post facto law as well. It makes punishments retroactive. So like something that was legal at the time the action occurred, it makes it illegal, which is unconstitutional. Our constitution expressly prohibits that. And even the DOJ came out and said, they sent us a memo saying this is unconstitutional. So we received a memo in our offices from the Trump Department of Justice saying this bill is unconstitutional. Now, I showed that to my colleagues, and they said, yeah, I agree, it's unconstitutional, and then they voted for it.
Hmm. Are they just dyslexic or something? I mean,
And that's disturbing. Yeah. I think that's really disturbing. I think we're going down a dangerous road with some of the free speech stuff. I want to be careful about how I phrase that in case it's cut and taken out of context. I love free speech. So
we're going to have a field day with that in editing.
You can't wait till you edit it. Yeah. We're going to dangerously with free speech here. No. So we must protect free speech. I think that we're heading into a gray area where some of our free speech protections are being weakened by new laws. And whether it's the right to protest or some of the religious liberty as well, I think we need to be really careful about this stuff and really vigilant. I think it's one of the biggest concerns we have going forward.
Let's open it up to questions. Preston, if you can grab the mic. And while we're waiting, is that a custom shirt?
No, it's not custom.
Banana Republic. Okay, so you're endorsing it. Did you just break a constitutional amendment or something by your...
I don't think
do you
so.
Have by stock?
No, fortunately, I'm not on the executive branch, so I'm okay.
Okay, all right. But now you're hoping that you'll get a bunch of Banana Republic. Yeah. It'll just be at
That's
home
right.
when you get there. Okay, do we have a mic? Let's go.
Justin, you explained that you often go back and talk to your constituents about your votes. Are there situations where you've explained it and they said that was the wrong decision and you had to change your thinking, or you stick with your guns no matter what?
So I don't think they've changed my mind about a vote. They've changed my mind about a couple things, not necessarily a vote, but for example, I had a lot of pushback this past year about having some kind of independent commission to investigate some of the Russia issues. And also people wanted the tax returns released. So I thought about this.
The Trump tax returns.
I thought about that over a long period of time and decided that it was okay to support those things if they were generally applicable. So like I wanted the tax returns, if it applies to all presidents, that's fine with me. I think it's a fair level of disclosure for someone we're trusting running the whole executive branch.
Do you also, are you in favor then of like Stormy Daniels releasing her taxes as well? and then it's, because this sounds like chain migration. Yeah, it's just pretty soon we're going to be so much paperwork, for people to get through.
Then I'm not going to answer that.
I just think we have our answer.
The bipartisan commission, I think that's fine. You should have some kind of, I mean, the the investigation that the House was doing was a joke. Both the Republicans and Democrats. I want to be clear about that. I mean, the Republicans were ridiculous. The Democrats were ridiculous. And both sides still are ridiculous on this thing. We should have some kind of independent.
When you get back to Congress, your desk is going to be out in the hall.
I tell people at town halls too. Let's have this investigation. Yeah. Both sides should like an independent investigation, then we can move on.
The idea if you're investigating something, these should be bipartisan or nonpartisan in these types of matters.
I think so. I mean, if it's very obviously a partisan investigation, which the House investigation has been, it doesn't tell you much. I mean, maybe the House Republicans are right, but they'll never convince people because it seems so partisan.
Do you feel like the independent counsel is truly independent or in this particular case?
I haven't seen any evidence that he's not independent. So I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Next question.
Yeah, Congressman, you've talked about the fact that two parties must die. You've talked about the barriers to a third party starting up. One obvious way to jumpstart this process would be, say, for example, you, Thomas Massey, Rand Paul, kind of jumping ship and moving to a third party. Can you imagine a scenario in which that happens, and what would that scenario look like?
Can I imagine such a scenario? I could imagine it. But
okay.
I think there are two impediments. I think in Michigan, for example, you have a straight ticket voting issue, which is a big problem in our state, and I think it's unconstitutional and they should get rid of it. The legislature actually did get rid of straight ticket voting, and then some Democrats filed a lawsuit to say that getting rid of straight ticket voting was unconstitutional, which is nuts. Like, most states don't have straight ticket voting. And I think it's not appreciated how much that impacts our elections in Michigan and how much it makes you tend toward Republicans or Democrats, just picking one party and getting out of there. So that's a big problem. The other thing I see is I'm not sure. I want to be careful about this, but I know I could make a decision like that. I'm not confident my colleagues would, for a number of reasons. They're principled people, but the situations are different. Like if you have my colleagues from Kentucky, that's a very different state. I don't know for sure how it works, and I don't want to prejudge the way they might be thinking about it. I mean, they have to think about it themselves about whether it would work. I think it could work in Michigan if you didn't have straight ticket voting in my neck of the woods or even statewide. I'm not sure about a state like Kentucky. I don't know.
Well, what about turning the Republican Party more libertarian? And, this is something that my colleague Matt Welch and my colleague Catherine Mangu Ward, people at Reason we've written a lot about it. And it seemed even a few years ago on the Tea Party wave and whatnot, the people who were coming into the Republican Party were about limiting spending, balancing the budget, getting out of a lot of social issues as a focus of national government. Can anything be done to make the Republican Party more libertarian?
Yeah, I think so, but
you can imagine.
I can imagine such a situation.
That we're deep into a Rick and Morty multiverse scenario, so right? Where it's
in an alternative universe. Yeah. I can imagine such a situation, but it's hard to sort of perceive, it was hard to perceive the whole Trump thing, that it was going to change the way the Republican Party views itself and change a lot of people's positions. I don't know. I think it's possible, but again, if you could change the Speaker of the House and have a libertarian Speaker of the House, an independent-minded Speaker of the House, you'd have a bigger chance of shifting the party.
So is Paul Ryan like a bully?
So you're trying to get me in as much trouble as possible.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like seventh grade all over again. You're talking about arbitrary authority.
Did he
dunk on you or something?
He's never dunked on me.
But you were also very much, and I mean, this was a real testament, I think, to your character and your principles. John Boehner really disliked you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is, you know.
But so. But in many respects, Boehner was the better speaker. And this is, I mean, it's hard to say. Like my friend,
certainly he looked better.
My friend Walter Jones said he might write an apology letter to Boehner for trying to oust him. But like the thing about Boehner was he didn't like you, but he was open about it. Like he and I appreciated that. I could appreciate that. I didn't think he did a good job as speaker, but I at least respected. That, like, if I wanted an amendment, even an example that actually happened, without telling you the specific words Boehner used, because they're not safe for work. But so I wanted an amendment on a bill, and he was getting a lot of pressure to put this amendment on the floor. So he called me into the back of the House chamber to meet with him. So we're just sitting there, like, in the House chamber. And it's mostly empty, and it's just two of us in the back row. And he pulls out a sheet of paper. And I'm like, what's he got on this piece of paper? Like, what's he going to read to me? And it's like I see a whole bunch of like small paragraphs. And I'm like, what is this thing? And he goes, I see you've been posting a lot on Facebook and Twitter. And he just starts ripping into me, swearing, calling me the worst names he can think of. And I won't tell you what he said because it was pretty extreme. But I even said to him, Mr. Speaker, I don't think you mean that about some of the things he said. I like... Like it, because it was really harsh stuff. And then he repeated it again with a few extra colorful adjectives. So he was pretty firm on his view of me. But then he said, I'm going to give you your damn amendment. And so he let me have the amendment vote. And I could respect that. I walked away thinking, well, that wasn't so bad. Yeah. Like he Now with Paul Ryan, there is no chance of that. He's not going to swear at me. He's not even going to consider me. He's not going to think about me. Like I'm not like there's no sense in which he'll even acknowledge that I exist. No. So it is a totally different dynamic, and it's worse in most respects because I would rather have the guy swearing at me and letting me have a vote than not considering me at all. And under this current speakership, we've had the fewest open amendments of any speakership. We've had zero. We've had zero open rules. So we haven't been able to offer amendments on bills on the House floor. We can't go to the House floor and offer our amendment on the floor. Everything has to be pre-approved by the Speaker. Every single amendment, pre-approved. And under Boehner, you had many opportunities where you could go to the floor and you could just walk up and leadership could not stop you because it was an open process and you could offer an amendment. And as long as it was germane to the bill, you got to vote on it. And this was true on basically all appropriations bills. Now we don't even do appropriations, really. They just come up with some omnibus bill. They spring it on us in the last second, and they say, this is the bill. Or they do a CR.
And we just continuing resolution.
Yeah, continuing resolution. So we don't have these opportunities anymore to debate amendments that we want to offer that aren't pre-approved by the leadership team.
Next question.
Yes, Congressman. Look, there's plenty to kick at. Within the three branches of government, especially Congress, given the facts and the bullshit we're constantly hearing, what's going right? What's happening that's good? We can look forward to.
Well, I think the tax cut bill is mostly good. At least it's marginally a beneficial bill. The legislation we passed and became law. Is it the best tax bill I've ever seen? Absolutely not. I think it falls short in so many areas. I think they really could have done a much better job at reforming the entire tax code and simplifying it. They didn't do any of that. Basically, they were able to cut rates. I think that'll be good for the economy, and that's a positive. I think the Trump administration has done a good job at rolling back some of the regulatory mistakes of the Obama administration. So that's also a positive sign.
Post offices. Yeah, they're doing pretty good.
I think Neil Gorsuch is a good Supreme Court pick. And from a libertarian perspective, probably we should be pleased. That's probably as good as you're going to get right now on the Supreme Court. We had done an analysis of all of the people that Trump had been considering for the Supreme Court, and my office independently thought Neil Gorsuch was the one who should get it, and he was the one who got it.
And you
so
are
out of
a
the
lawyer
list of all
training.
The people that he had. So
you're a lawyer by training.
Yeah, so. I'm a lawyer.
So we shouldn't believe anything you say.
So I think you can decide that for yourself. Yeah. So I think there are some good things that have happened, but again, in Congress, we're mostly spinning our wheels. Most of the legislation is not really substantive. It is minor stuff. It's getting a new report on this or something, or a post office named, or some kind of land transfer in Utah, which, you know, maybe matters to people of Utah, but it generally is not
what
a big
about
federal
the
issue.
You know, I mean, the tax bill, you know, it definitely is, you know, on its own, it's an improvement. It reduces revenue, but spending didn't go down. How much should that concern people that, you know, and Republicans are always willing to cut taxes. Democrats are often willing to cut taxes, but nobody wants to cut spending.
Yeah, it should definitely concern people. So the way I look at it, when I analyze legislation, I want lower taxes and lower spending. So when I get a bill to cut taxes, I don't know how you can expect me not to support cutting taxes when that's my belief. I believe in lower taxes and I believe in lower spending. When we get bills that increase spending, I'm going to be voting no on those bills. I think you have to keep fighting for what you believe in, keep pushing people to do the right thing. And just this coming week, we're going to have another spending bill. So we need, you know, our people out there talking about this, pushing the Congress, pushing the president on this issue that we can't keep spending all this money. You wouldn't believe how many letters I received in my office from business people in my district telling me, hey, we really need you to cut taxes and repeal Obamacare. And I went back to a lot of these people and I said, well, we did that. We tried to repeal Obamacare. We cut taxes. Can I get some letters now about cutting spending? You need to send those letters to me. Send those letters to my office. Send those letters to my colleague's office. Tell us you're not going to support us if we don't cut spending. We don't get those letters. We don't get those letters. We'll get plenty of letters about cutting taxes, repealing Obamacare, or some parochial interest, something that just affects your company and your district or whatever. But we don't get anything on, hey, can we get our budget in order? Can we get fiscal restraints put back in place? So that is a huge problem. So that's a call for people in the business community, the donor community, to get engaged and press members of Congress, press the White House.
Next question.
Congressman, welcome to Florida. You're a hero to many here and to many all over the world.
Thanks.
Great point about the two parties being smaller and the nastier elements, you know, are the ones that are left over and they're more partisan. It really burns me up when I see them attacking libertarian Republicans, like cheering on Rand Paul's attacker or going on your Twitter feed and attacking you personally and calling you names. That just burns me up to see that. I mean, I think it's partly the reason is that you and other principled libertarian Republicans are taking position that they themselves are too timid or afraid to take. Is there anyone on the other side of the aisle that you can work with? Like Ron Paul used to work with Dennis Kucinich on a few issues that had to do with foreign policy and civil liberties and stuff like that. Thank you.
Yeah, we work with a lot of people. We've worked with Tulsi Gabbard on a number of foreign policy issues. I work with Zoe Lofgren on surveillance issues. Jared Polis on a variety of liberty issues. He's running for governor in Colorado now, so he's going to be leaving Congress. Earl Blumenauer on certain issues. So whether it's like drug policy or surveillance or foreign policy, there are always Democrats that we can work with. And I think it's important to have those relationships, have those alliances. I want to work with Democrats where I agree with them, and where I don't agree with them, that's fine. We don't agree. I mean, there are plenty of Republicans I don't agree with as well. And I think it's a mistake to take libertarian Republicans like me or Rand Paul or Massey and say, oh, what are they doing in the Republican Party? You know, they're not really living up to libertarianism because they sold out and became Republicans or ran as Republicans. Look, what matters is what are we doing in Congress? What are we doing? And Rand and I aren't going to agree on everything. Massey and I aren't going to agree on everything. You're not going to agree with me on everything. That's fine. Like, there's no, you're not going to find the ideal libertarian who fits with you on every single issue. It's not going to happen. Just like Republicans don't agree on everything and Democrats don't agree on everything. So I think we need to be a little bit more understanding. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't have certain expectations about how they operate, a certain minimum threshold. They have to be able to achieve this much as libertarians to be considered libertarian. But I think it's a mistake to judge all libertarian Republicans as somehow having sold out because they're running as Republicans.
Next question.
You want us all to write our congressmen a letter and ask them to reduce spending. We write them all a letter, and they reduce spending by cutting out some welfare mother's cheese, and that gets a big headline. Nobody ever talks about cutting the big spending up there on Capitol Hill of Nancy Pelosi's salary, and I'm just using her as an example, and her jet travel, and all of them that have jet planes up there, which I know how much they cost.
Yeah.
And that, and so that is as far as that spending is concerned and cutting spending. Cut in your own house first.
Is it true that you
cut
guys,
in your house first?
You also get.
But as, wait a minute. I'm not finished.
Okay, Norman, lay it on me, baby. Okay.
You shouldn't interrupt me. You don't know what score I got on that. I think that military and defense should have some kind of separation, because defense did need spending infusion because of all of the equipment. I mean, we're robbing from graveyard equipment to fix other equipment. So that does need to be fixed. But then the military, which you've got the military, and that is nothing but a huge, huge, big expense of golf courses and people overpaid. And speaking of being able to go on forever, I could, but I won't. But those are just two
Thank
things.
You.
Yeah. Yeah. So I agree with you. We should look at our own house. And when we look at legislative branch appropriations, I think that's actually one of the few areas where they have made some cuts over recent years because of embarrassment, frankly. But
so this is what, like cutting, getting rid of the barber shop or
reduced
price lunches?
Right, they get rid of a few things here and there. So I think you should look at that stuff first and make sure there's no waste in government. I absolutely agree with you. There should be no waste. Nobody should be spending money on flights on taxpayers' dime that are, you know, frivolous flights where they're going here and there. So I'm with you on all that. The biggest portion of the budget by far, though, are areas that people don't want to touch: Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So you have to, and military spending is part of that too. So you have to touch those areas and military spending if you want to get the budget under control. You have to have some reforms to those areas. They make up the vast majority of the budget. And I have pressed my colleagues for years that they need to look at the military budget if they want to get compromise on the other areas. So if you want to get reductions elsewhere, you need to look at your own stuff too. Just when the when the election was going on, or maybe after the election, President Trump tweeted about all the waste in the military budget, like $125 billion per year of waste. Well, we should look at that first. Before we increase the spending, you look at that first. And then you talk to the Democrats and say, hey, we have to get these other programs, these large mandatory programs, under control. And that doesn't mean changing benefits immediately for people who are retired or who are about to retire. I think that if you have an expectation that you're going to get a Social Security check or Medicare, whatever else we think about these programs, I think you don't want to jar people by changing those expectations. It's too late for someone who's retired to say, well, I didn't save up enough because I was expecting Social Security or Medicare to take care of me. It's too late for them. So I think you can't change the expectations on them like that. But for people who are 20 or 30 years old, I think you need to change the expectations right now. You need to change expectations and change these programs so that they don't operate the same way. Kind of like if you have someone that goes from goes to a defined benefits to a contribution program. So we need to change the attitude now before it gets too late. And then the next generation is not going to have these programs. It's not going to work. And not only not have those programs, the whole budget's going to blow up. Nothing else will be funded.
As a final comment, we got midterm elections coming up in a few months. What can you kind of gaze into a crystal ball? What do you think is going to happen, and how will that affect the next couple of years in terms of politics?
I think Republicans are going to have a very tough time in the upcoming election. That that Pennsylvania 18 race is, I think, really indicative of a bigger wave across the country. If you look at all the previous races, Republicans have struggled the previous races in this term. Republicans have struggled. Now, they've won some of those by slim margins. I think people put too much stock in the idea that, Connor Lamb was such a great candidate and the other guy, Saccone, was a bad candidate. I think people put too much stock in that. Being a good or bad candidate, when you are a new candidate running for office, being a good or bad candidate, I think, can move you up or down maybe 2 or 3 points. That's it. 2 or 3 points from what else would happen. Like if Connor Lamb were a terrible candidate, he might have lost that race 51-48 or 52-47. If he were terrible, absolutely terrible, the worst candidate they could put up. And that's what I think people don't appreciate enough, that the wave, and I recognize this in my own district and in other districts, when you look at election results, the wave is much bigger than anything that individual candidates do. We have lots of morons in Congress, lots of people who got elected because of a wave, because there was some bigger thing moving them in than their own campaigns. They could run lousy campaigns and get elected. So don't put too much stock in a candidate being great and another candidate being bad. So I think it's going to be tough for Republicans. I think we will lose a lot of seats.
Will that be good, though? I mean, would that open up a political discussion that might not happen otherwise in a libertarian direction, or is it just darkness?
So I think it will give us an opportunity to reassess. And I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how that reassessment will work. But it will give Republicans an opportunity to reassess. Are we a national populist party, or are we a limited government party? And we need to decide that as a party. We need to think about that, because those are not small differences. Those are big differences. And, I could go on for another hour talking about the difference between Europe and the United States and why politics is so disastrous in Europe. Why you have these conservative parties that are, essentially nationalist parties, how they're totally different from what we've thought of traditionally as conservative parties here, and the dangers of moving in that direction. It's dangerous to move in the direction of Europe, where our conservative party is a national populist party, and our democratic party, or the progressive party, is like a socialist party, which is what happens in Europe. That's very dangerous. It will lead to a lot of disruption in our society. It will make us poorer. It will make us less happy. I think we take for granted this country way too often, and the beauty of liberty, and our ability to associate, our ability to integrate people here, our ability to work with people who are different. I think we take for granted the kind of diversity we have here, the respect for each other we have. I think trust more than anything else, the trust we have in each other is taken for granted. people in other parts of the world do not trust each other like Americans do. Americans are really trusting of each other. And that is a very good characteristic of Americans, that we trust each other. It allows our system to work. It allows our system to work. And if you have a society where people don't trust each other, that is very dangerous. The whole thing breaks down and you get much bigger government and you are way less free as a society. So I guess I'll close on that.
Well, yeah, thank you. Thank you. Thank Congressman Justin Amash, Republican of Michigan, again. Thanks so much both for speaking so candidly today and also what you do when you're on the clock.
And I want to say thank you to Reason, you know, for inviting me here today, but also for influencing me as a young person. You know, Reason's one of the first things I started to read when I started to really think about politics, and it made an impact on my life as well.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.